So the response of some of the professional musicians and the musician establishment, as it were, I guess we're talking about the American Federation of Musicians local here in San Francisco.
Well, it was general. All the locals all over the country, the musicians that I contacted, there was no program for education, and I don't think there still is in the American Federation of Musicians as far as the background of where the music originated.
But you've described to me a situation not so much of ignorance, but even hostility on the part of some musicians toward this music.
Well, there was much hostility. There was such hostility amongst the ethnic groups and the musicians' unions were segregated at that time, and they weren't integrated until, I believe, in the middle of 1945. There were two unions, and musicians' unions in San Francisco.
Do you think the fact that you were white musicians playing black music led to problems, or it irritated some people?
It caused much resentment amongst other musicians because of the choice of the repertoire and the basis of the Yerba Buena band's library. And we were playing Jeller Old Morton's music and King Oliver's and Scott Joplin's and many black composers. And in fact, I would say probably a preponderance of black, and that didn't sit right either. Because there's still this animosity about the music, and there shouldn't have been any. Music is everybody's.
Yeah, I feel that way too. Was there any animosity from the blacks about whites playing black music?
I think not really animosity, but I've been suggested by a couple of guys, what are you playing those old cornball tunes for? Why don't you get hip?
So they viewed it as essentially an artifact.
Yeah, long gone stuff, long dead stuff. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. In fact, the general attitude was not only amongst black musicians or white musicians, all musicians, that every day in every way were getting more modern. Catch this lick, Jack. You know, this is
the newest.
This is the Ian Lick.
Thank you. sitting there on that golden stair.
Yes, my lord.
Oh, roll, Johnny, roll. Roll, Johnny, roll. I want to go to heaven when I die to hear Jordan roll.
Clearly the band had to have some arrangements and some idea of how to play this music. How did you actually go about working up, say, a tune like Skedaddy Dat from Little Hardin or a Roll Jordan Roll?
Well, we didn't set out to copy any of the King Olivers or Jelly Roll Morton's record note for note, but to assimilate the foundation and way of approach to the music. And in order to get away from the tightly arranged things where everybody had been before with the hotel bands and the ballroom bands that play note for note off the arrangements and stocks, it was decided that it wouldn't help to write everything out anyway and leave it to the individual's musical integrity to assimilate what was meant by the score. So in order to do that, the best way we found was to make the notation as simple as possible, establish the lines of the different parts playing that was trying to be expressed by whoever wrote the tune, and leave it to the individuals to assimilate the ideas. And that basically was the foundation of all the writing.
As it turned out, it worked quite successfully. I'd say monumentally successfully in the case of the Yerba Buena Band.
I believe it was the right way to go, and we found out later, at that time, all of the supply of charts that have become available these days were not even thought about or even considered in those days. So what we had to go by was what we heard on the records. And
so it was mostly done, it was done literally by ear?
It was done by playing records and a loose, very loose chart, like a road map, like a state road map instead of a county map.
Just sort of laying out the chorus and verse and what key is.
Instead of putting down all the small towns and villages.
Every note and every pause and emphasis and tutti and forte.
A general line that was established.
Thank you. as we're listening to these Yerba Buena Jazz Band recordings, we've heard Roll Jordan Roll and Lil Hardin's Skedaddy Dat. Let's see, I think we've got Sage Hen Strutt here next up. Sage Hen Strutt and Chattanooga, these were both recorded on West Coast in early 1946. I think you were describing to me how those sessions were actually recorded.
Well, it was a very tricky arrangement. Actually, Dave, the band wanted to get a present sound of a ballroom or a large club without going into the echo chamber or using a batch of microphones to do this. So we decided that the best way to go would take a tip from the late 20s recording techniques and go with fewer mics and play in a hall where everybody could hear themselves. That's back to the old concert hall idea, and the one that was picked out that had the best acoustics was the Avalon Ballroom on Sutter Street near Van Ness. Well, it wasn't set up to record, not at that time anyway, so the only way that could be done was piping the music over telephone down to studios across from the Palace Hotel on Montgomery Street.
Where the record was actually being cut.
Photo and Sound down there had their studios across from the Palace. And
so you sent the signal over a couple of miles over telephone line from the ballroom.
3 miles of telephone wire, I guess, including all the communications back and forth, which had to be... The engineering was done down there, and the microphones, of course, were at the Avalon. The first session, we had forgotten to stuff the ballroom's phones, the house phones, and they spoiled quite a few takes by that way, by ringing in the middle of a tune. Mm-hmm. So that went on for about 1 day, and then we scotched that, but we had to do a lot of things we did the first day over again. And I guess this went on a period of maybe several months. I forget how many sessions there were or how many records, but all the West Coast records were done that way. Thank you.
Dave Radlauer. You're listening to Jazz Rhythm on KALW and a pre-taped interview with Bob Helm. We're listening to recordings Bob made in 1946 through about 1950 with the Yerba Buena Jazz Band of Lou Waters. These are rare 78s. Some of them have been reissued. However, earlier we heard rare acetates of the Yerba Buena Jazz Band rehearsals at the Mark Twain Hotel. Still ahead in this broadcast, we'll hear Bob Helm talking and playing about and with Turk Murphy. We'll also hear his 1954 Riverside Roustabouts. And in 2 weeks, we'll feature his more recent projects, dating from as early as 1972 with Earl Sheeler's Funky New Orleans Jazz Band, an exclusive Santa Rosa concert with Jacques Côté's Creole Rice Yerba Buena Jazz Band. We'll also hear Bob with a number of stomp-off releases from Chris Tile's New Orleans Rover Boys, the South Frisco Jazz Band, and Down Home, the brand new release from the stomp-off company featuring Bob Helm, the Dawn Club Joys. Continuing to listen to some of the recordings that my guest Bob Helm helped to make in the late 1940s with Lou Waters' Yerba Buena Jazz Band. This is Jazz Rhythm. I'm Dave Radlauer, your host, and it's my privilege to have Bob Helm in the KALW studio for this interview. There were a lot of recordings made from Hambone Kelly's. After the Dawn Club closed in San Francisco, it seems like the East Bay then sort of became the focus of activity for a while.
Well, there was a long, several months period for a search to find a suitable place to put the band, and The Don Club was a natural, but it had a lien against it by the government for taxes that weren't paid during World War II. And so Lou wanted to continue on looking for a place rather than going on the road. And the search went around the Bay Area. The place that turned up was in the East Bay, and old Sally Rand's old Hollywood Club on San Pablo Avenue.
Oh, Sally Rand, the famous the fan dancer?
Yeah, that's the one. The club had been closed. I guess Sally Rand had a disagreement with her partners. When we first took a look at the place, it was set up as a supper club with Sally doing the headline act, and they had a chorus line, of course, and the usual show, the floor show, and dinner club, and it looked like all the dinners, the diners, somehow had yelled fire, and they just split the club. Everything was, some of the utensils were still on the table, and there was some half-eaten chicken and steak on the plates, and the place has just been padlocked, evidently, all of a sudden.
So then did the Yerba Buena band...
What? We had to clean it all up, Dave. And
so literally the band took responsibility for the club.
Well, Lou was mostly responsible for getting the money together to secure a lease and get the liquor license and stock the food and liquor cabinets. And there was a lot of painting and renovating and reorganizing to do, such as a dance floor to be built. And the bars were remodeled, and the kitchen needed equipment. And so all things like that. And it finally all came together with the help of a lot of friends. I think we opened a very auspicious day, like Friday the 13th. In May or June of 1947, and continued on for till 1950. That was with the original band that had been at the Dawn Club.
Let's focus for a moment on the music itself. I think on Alcoholic Blues there's a duet that you're in.
Oh, that's just the opening chorus of it with a trombone lead with a clarinet playing the harmony part, duet form.
Mm-hmm. And then most people think of Lou as a guy that played straight horn most of the time.
Oh, no, Lou used mutes and used glasses. And one of his favorites was using a large tumbler over the bell of his horn.
And so we can hear that on this.
I think you'll hear it in the background, playing the background black of Clancy's vocal
on Alcoholic Blues.
Got the blues, I got the alcoholic blues. No more beer, my heart to cheer. No more whiskey, used to make me frisky. So long, highball, goodbye, Jill. Tell me when you're coming back again.